Genesis 21:1-21, the 23rd talk in a series on Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on September 1, 2002 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. This recording may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm going to be teaching from Genesis chapter 21. I have been teaching through Genesis and haven't taught for about a year. And I think this is where I left off. I hope this is where I left off. I'm pretending this is where I left off. If I've already taught this, I hope what I say today is somewhat compatible with what I said before. This is my third time working through Genesis, and I enjoy it immensely. Every time I work through it, I see things that I hadn't seen before. And it is a challenge to interpret historical narrative, trying to figure out why the author put the stuff together, why he chose what he chose to talk about, and why he talks about it the way that he does. That's a real big challenge. But the way I see it is kind of like putting together a jigsaw puzzle in which many of the pieces are shaped the same. So there are a lot of pieces that can go together, but when you look at the image on the two pieces, it either clearly does not fit, or sometimes you can't quite tell whether those two pieces go together or not. And it isn't until you get a bigger section together that you can tell whether you've put those pieces together right or wrong. So Genesis, I think, is like that, and I feel like I've put a few of the clumps of pieces together, but I won't know for sure until I've put the whole book together, and ultimately until I've even put Genesis in the context of the Bible. So obviously it's a work in process. Today I'm going to work through the story of the birth of Isaac. My plan is to just tell the story. And then there are a couple of issues that I'd like to talk about out of that story. One is an observation with respect to the dilemma, the moral dilemma that Abraham faces in this chapter. And the other one is I want to talk about the significance of the name of Isaac. I think that's an interesting issue. But first of all, let's go through the story. This story of the birth of Isaac is central to the history of mankind from God's perspective. It's certainly central to the story of Genesis. This is one of the highlights. This is one of the key moments in the storyline of Genesis. Certainly everything from chapter 12 up to this time has been leading to the birth of Isaac. But it seems to me that even before that, right from chapter 1, there is a sense in which it's leading up to the birth of Isaac. In chapter 1, Moses begins the story in Genesis talking about God's creation of the universe. But what's interesting in that story is, as he depicts it, things start out before God begins his creative activity in darkness and chaos. So God's creative activity consists of bringing light into the darkness and bringing order to the chaos. That same process then continues in the rest of Genesis, but here God turns his attention on mankind. And what we see in Genesis 3 through 11 is that darkness reigns in the hearts of man. It starts with Adam and Eve, but we see that darkness also reigns in Cain and the descendants of Cain. We see darkness reigning in the hearts of man during the time of Noah. Darkness reigns in the hearts of man in Nimrod, at the Tower of Babel, etc. So the question that you're left with at the end of chapter 11 is, how can light and order be brought into the lives of mankind? And then in chapter 12, we begin the story of God's activity in the world to bring that light and order into mankind's life. And he picks this nobody, Abraham, and he blesses him. He invades his life, and he brings light in the form of understanding, and he brings order in the form of obedience and trust. So that begins the process by which God is going to bring light and order into mankind, and Abraham is exhibit A. But in the process of this, God makes promises to Abraham, a number of promises, and some of those promises cannot be filled in Abraham's lifetime. Let's look at just the very first promise that he makes to him. This is in chapter 12. This is when God first speaks to Abraham. Verse 1. Now the Lord said to Abraham, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. And I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great. And so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Well, just at face value, there are a couple of things here that are not fulfilled in Abraham's lifetime. For instance, I will make you a great nation. And look at the last line, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. That's a truly great promise, but it is not one to be fulfilled in Abraham's lifetime. So Abraham understands early on that this God with whom he has to do has made promises to him that cannot be fulfilled in his lifetime. That implies an heir. There has to be an inheritor of this promise through whom these will come to be. Now, God didn't make it clear right from the beginning how this was going to happen. God did not spell it out at the beginning. It comes out in bits and pieces. And in Genesis chapter 12 through 20, we see the evolution of Abraham's thinking and the evolution of how God develops his revelation to Abraham with respect to his heir. In Genesis 13:16, God says to Abraham that his descendants will be as the dust of the earth. So presumably he's going to have a child, at least, who is going to, they are going to have, go on to have other children, so his descendants are going to be numerous. He's got to have at least one. And Abraham begins to think about this. The first promise that was made to him was made when Abraham was 75 years old. But time keeps passing. His wife is 65 when the promise is first made, Sarah. And so he begins to think, well, my heir must be my adopted son. He adopts a son and thinks that that is the one through whom these promises will be carried out. But in Genesis 15:4, God says, no. He says, one will who will come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir. So it becomes clearer, he's not going to have an heir through adoption, but he's going to have an heir from his own flesh and blood. But time keeps passing. It becomes less and less likely that he is going to have a child through Sarah. So Sarah has the idea, have a child through Hagar, my maid. And he has a child, Ishmael. But after Ishmael is born, God comes again to Abraham, and we see, I'll read this, it's Genesis 17. He makes it clearer who the heir will be. 17, 15 through 21. Then God said to Abraham, as for Sarai your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. And I will bless her, and indeed I will give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples shall come from her. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed, and said in his heart, will a child be born to a man 100 years old? And will Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? And Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before thee. But God said, no, but Sarah your wife shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. And as for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I will bless him and will make him fruitful and will multiply him exceedingly. He shall become the father of 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you at this season next year. So here, finally, at the age of 99, God is making it specific. You will have a child through your wife, Sarah, and that child will be born 1 year from now. So there's an appointed time and definitely an heir through Sarah. So what's really curious about this to me is God was very stingy with his information. Instead of telling Abraham right up front when he was 75 years old, this is what's going to happen, he lets Abraham struggle with this. Is it going to happen or is it not? And if it's going to happen, how is it going to happen? And what is my role in bringing this about? What are the moves that I am to make to bring this about? And he struggles, and it seems to me makes some mistakes along the way. But finally, when it is more unlikely than ever, God makes it clear, you will have a child through Sarah, and that will be the heir. So this is a momentous event in Genesis. This is a big deal. Because the birth of Isaac means that God keeps his promises. And that's important because much of what Abraham is going on is these promises that can't be fulfilled in his own lifetime. They are promises for the future. Are they true or is it wishful thinking? And Isaac is like the down payment. Isaac is God's statement, I keep my promises. You can count on the promises that are to come. Okay, let's read the account in Genesis chapter 21. We'll read the first 21 verses, if my bifocals will cooperate. Then the Lord took note of Sarah, as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had promised. So Sarah conceived and bore a son to Abraham in his old age, at the appointed time of which God had spoken to him. And Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac. Then Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. Now Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. And Sarah said, God has made laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh with me. And she said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I have borne him a son in his old age. And the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. Now Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, mocking. Therefore, she said to Abraham, "Drive out this maid and her son, for the son of this maid shall not be an heir with my son Isaac." And the matter distressed Abraham greatly because of his son. But God said to Abraham, "Do not be distressed because of the lad and your maid. Whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her, for through Isaac your descendants shall be named. And of the son of the maid, I will make a nation also, because he is your descendant." So Abraham rose early in the morning and took bread and a skin of water and gave them to Hagar, putting them on her shoulder, and gave her the boy and sent her away. And she departed and wandered about in the wilderness of Beersheba. And the water in the skin was used up, and she left the boy under one of the bushes. Then she went and sat down opposite him, about a bow shot away, for she said, "Do not let me see the boy die." And she sat opposite him and lifted up her voice and wept. And God heard the lad crying, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, "What is the matter with you, Hagar? Do not fear, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad, and hold him by the hand, for I will make a great nation of him." Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water, and she went and filled the skin with water and gave the lad a drink. And God was with the lad, and he grew, and he lived in the wilderness and became an archer. And he lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. So the birth of Isaac happens on schedule, as God had promised. And it is a moment of great rejoicing. We have Sarah, she's laughing with joy. And she says, "All who hear will laugh with me." This is a big moment. This is very significant. And furthermore, it's miraculous. Who would have thunk it? Who would have said that a child would be born to Abraham at such an old age? So clearly, this is a moment of great rejoicing. It's a big event. And a feast is held at the time of weaning. Now, the time of weaning probably was about 3 years old. So that's a long time by our standards, but that was apparently the customary time. So at this time, a big feast is held. Isaac is about 3 years old, and that would make Ishmael about 17 years old. For 14 years then, Ishmael was an only son. For 14 years, Ishmael probably basked in his father's attention and was the only object of his father's attention as far as children. Now comes this interloper. Now comes Isaac. And all of a sudden, all of this attention is thrown on Isaac because he's this miraculous child and the heir of the promises. And an incident occurs at that feast, and the incident is very cryptic. In my translation, it says that the son of Hagar was mocking. I don't know what your translations say. There are a variety of ways that this is translated. Some say he was playing. Some say he was playing with Isaac. But here the translation is mocking. Now it's a little bit difficult to sort out exactly what's going on here. It is extremely cryptic. But the word that's used here has a variety of possible meanings. It can be a very innocent thing. It can mean just playing. But it can mean joking or mocking. Or it could be even stronger. It could mean abusing. And according to some commentaries, especially the Jewish commentaries, tend to think that it is a quite strong term here. the kind of abuse could be verbal, but it could also be physical or sexual. So we have a wide range of possibilities of what's going on here. It seems highly likely to me that it's not just innocent playing. Something is happening here that justifies Sarah's anger. That this is the reason, this is the catalyst for Sarah becoming upset. And I think we're to believe that that he has done something that is not innocent, something that is at least in some way inappropriate. I am not inclined to think that it is physical or sexual abuse, because Abraham's response is much more measured. If it were physical or sexual abuse, it seems to me that Abraham's response would be at least a certain amount of outrage towards the child. So I think that it's some kind of disrespect that is being shown towards Isaac. Clear disrespect. Paul, in Galatians 4:29, is talking about this section of Genesis and is using it as an allegory to actually make a theological point. But in the course of using this allegory, he refers to this particular thing and indicates that Ishmael was, and the word he uses is persecuting Isaac. So that's another reason I think it's not just an innocent kind of playing. And the third thing that's interesting here is Ishmael's name is never mentioned in this account. Throughout the account, it's either Hagar's son, Abraham's son, or the lad. But it's never Ishmael. And I suspect that's an indication of infamy. He did something of which he ought to be ashamed. Okay, so I think something happened here, and I think that it was not outrageous, but it is a clear sign of disrespect towards this heir to the promises. And that's easy to imagine. It's easy to envision why Ishmael in his position would be jealous of this little kid that comes in and takes his position of prominence. Okay, so Sarah is outraged. She wants Ishmael and Hagar to be driven out. And the word driven can be translated divorce. That same word is used to mean divorce. He wants them out of the household, them broken off. Now, the relations between Sarah and Hagar had been strained for some time. Because if you remember back to the account of when Ishmael was, well, when Hagar became pregnant with Ishmael, she was disrespectful towards Sarah, and Sarah was outraged. And she wanted something done about that, and Abraham said, do what is proper in your own eyes. And she drove Hagar and she's pregnant with Ishmael, drove Hagar out of the tents. And they went into the desert, and the angel of the Lord appeared to Hagar and said, go back and submit to your mistress. Hagar did return, and we have no indications, at least in the text, that Hagar was disrespectful after that, but we don't know. But it's easy to see that things are tense between Sarah and Hagar, and Sarah might be quick to take offense at Hagar's actions. In any case, Sarah wants Hagar and Ishmael out of here. Well, that puts Abraham in a difficult predicament. Obviously, he wants to be loyal to his wife, Sarah. But he also feels an obligation to his son. He may also feel an obligation to Hagar as well. And he knows if he sends them out on their own, that's taking a big risk. Something serious could happen to them. They could even die. So here Abraham is stuck between a rock and a hard place, a very difficult kind of moral dilemma where he has contrasting responsibilities that come into conflict. And he has to sort this out. His response is that driving them away would be wrong. But God comes to him and says, no, send them out. Do what Sarah says. Don't worry, I will take care of them. I will make of Ishmael a great nation. Go ahead and do what Sarah says. Then he goes on to say, and this is, I think, significant as the reason for sending them out. I just have to find it. Verse 12. Do not be distressed because of the lad and your maid. Whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her. And here's the reason. For through Isaac, your descendants, and the word there is sometimes translated seed, through Isaac your seed shall be named. And the son of the maid I will make a nation also, because he is your, and it's the same word there, descendant or seed. But he must be using those in two different senses. Isaac is his seed in the sense that he is the one who will inherit the promises. Ishmael is your descendant and a seed in that sense. And because he is a descendant of yours, he too will be made a great nation. But he is not the seed in the first sense. That is, he is not the one to inherit the promises. And God wants to make this sharp distinction. Isaac will inherit, Ishmael will not. When we're talking about this, the promises that had been made to God, the covenant that God had made with Abraham. So, in God's wisdom, he wants Hagar and Ishmael driven out of the household. He is making a clear separation. Ishmael will not inherit the promises, will not inherit the covenant. The next morning, Abraham gets up early. And we'll see that that's not uncommon with Abraham. He wants to do the right thing. He gets up early. He goes around and makes provisions for them, gathers up what they will need for their trip, and supplies Hagar and Ishmael with those things, and then sends them on their way. And it must have been a difficult moment for Abraham to do that. Hagar and Ishmael, they leave. They go wandering in the desert and apparently get lost. And they run out of water. There's no water to be found. Ishmael is apparently suffering the most. And so Hagar leaves Ishmael under a tree, and she goes away because she doesn't want to watch him die. There's nothing she can do, but she doesn't want to watch him die. So she goes a distance away. And there she cries out to God. And God responds, and he says, don't worry, I'm going to make a great nation out of Ishmael. And I will take care of you. And after God speaks to her, she notices that there is a spring. And she goes and gives water to the boy. The boy recovers. The boy recovers and grows up to be a man, and it says that he became an archer. Now that's interesting. I'm not sure the significance of this. But one thing that is noticeable in Hebrew historical narrative is they like to use word associations. Notice earlier how it states how far away Hagar was from Ishmael. It's a bow shot. And then later he becomes an archer. Well, he could have described that distance differently, but he uses bow shot. I bring that up not because I know what it means here, but it is an interesting phenomenon, and I'm going to draw upon it later in just a little bit. Okay, so that is the basic story. There are a couple of things that I would like, a couple of observations that I would like to make with respect to the story. The first is just an observation. I really don't have anything profound to say about it. I can only commiserate. And that is Abraham's predicament. I suspect that you have all been in a situation in which you have conflicting responsibilities. You have different sets of responsibilities that come into conflict one with the other, and you have to work out, how am I going to meet my responsibilities in a responsible way, in a way that is obedient to God? Whether it be as husband and father, that can come into conflict. Son and husband, that can come into conflict. Employee and family, that can come into conflict. Employer, your responsibility to your employer or your family. There are any number of ways that responsibilities can come into conflict. Or that moral requirements, other kinds of moral requirements, can come into conflict. There's the kind of paradigmatic moral dilemma of being in Nazi Germany, and you're hiding Jews in your house, and the Nazi soldier comes to the door and says, are there any Jews in here? What do you do? You have this responsibility to be a servant of the truth on the one hand, but you also have to be one who is respectful of human life on the other hand. And you know that those Jews will be whisked away to their death. I remember a number of years ago talking to a fellow. He is no longer around, so I don't think that I would be betraying any confidences. He was working for one of these companies that published phone books, phone directories. It was after the breakup of AT&T, and there were all these different phone books coming out and all trying to compete for people's advertising. He was selling advertising in the yellow pages of that book, and he had sold tens of thousands of dollars worth of advertising. But his employer came to him and said, and to the whole sales team, and said, we are on the verge of going bankrupt. The only way that we are going to survive and are going to be able to print these phone books is if you go out and sell more ads. Because if you do not sell enough more ads, then we're going bankrupt, and the phone books won't be published at all. So he came to me and said, what should I do? And of course I said, how should I know? I mean, what a horrible dilemma to be put in. Because you have been going around in good faith saying, pay me for these ads that we will publish. And they had made down payments on those ads. And he had sold tens of thousands of dollars worth of ads. And those people risked losing that money that they had paid, that he had solicited. And his employer is saying, your only way out is to go out and in good faith sell some more. And if you don't, it won't be published. So what do you do? That's a horrible dilemma. And yet those kinds of things happen in life, where we're faced with those conflicting responsibilities, conflicting duties. And here Abraham is in one of those situations, and we'll see Abraham has been in one of those before with Hagar. What do you do there? Do you do what Sarah has proposed and take Hagar as a wife, or do you not? And in the next chapter, he's got the one where God asks him to sacrifice his son Isaac. So God is putting Abraham through the ringer. He's putting him through a number of these moral dilemmas that are very, very difficult and hard to sort out. The thing that's interesting to me is that's the way God does it. God didn't have to do it this way. God could have given us each a coin that we flip. Heads, I do it. Tails, I don't. I mean, ask a yes or no question, flip the coin, and that's what I do. And he could have made things clearer had he wanted to. He could have had a means by which he told us, do X and don't do Y. But he didn't. Instead, he has left it to us to sort it out and struggle through those issues. And I'm convinced that there's an important trade-off here that we need to understand. One is, we learn a lot about ourselves in the process. I know I have when I've been in those situations. Because you agonize over, do I want what God wants or do I want what I want? And if we're really tricky, like I can be, we disguise what I want under the name of what God wants and feel good about ourselves. But it's sorting that through and being honest with ourselves that's the real trial. It's the real difficult thing to do, but it is so instructive. So apparently God has put a premium on us coming to know ourselves, learning about ourselves. What he sacrifices is us getting it right. We're going to get it wrong a lot. We're all going to get it wrong a lot. Those are tough choices. Those would be tough choices for anyone to resolve. So we're going to get a lot of them wrong. That means that living life is, to a large extent, bumbling along. We're all bumbling along. It is unfortunately the case that no one lives life gracefully. We're all klutzes. We're all bozos on this bus. Okay. Now, the other thing I'd like to talk about is the significance of the name Isaac. I think this is very interesting. The name Isaac means he laughs. It's not clear who the he is, but it's he laughs. The interesting thing in this narrative, however, is that virtually everyone laughs with respect to Isaac. When God came to Abraham when he was 99 years old and said, you will have a son through Sarah, as we read, what was his response? He laughed. A little bit later, they tell Sarah that she will have a son. And her response is she laughed inside. And the angel said, why do you laugh? And Sarah said, I didn't laugh. And the angel said, yes, you did. Both of them responded by laughing because it's absurd to think that a woman of 90 is going to have a child. That doesn't happen. But when the child is born, Sarah laughs again. But this time it's a laughter of joy. It's a laughter of God keeps his promises. God did what he said he would do. It's rejoicing. But there's another response of laughter as well. When it says what Ishmael did, the word that here is translated mocked, but can be translated played, that word is from the same word laugh. So there's a sense in which Ishmael too laughed. But it was a different kind of laugh. His was a laugh of scorn. In thinking about it, it occurred to me, and I'm helped by Kierkegaard in this respect. The response of mankind to all of God's, I'll call it salvific activity, his plan of salvation. Every part of that plan of salvation is absurd. If you think about it, your first response is, that's absurd. I mean, let's just go through some of the key points in that. Picking Abraham, picking this nobody, and blessing him and saying, I will make of you a great nation. Why would he pick an insignificant man and bless the descendants of that insignificant man and start his whole plan of salvation through that person? Give to that, to the descendants of that man, the land of Palestine. Why Palestine? Why nowhere? I was reading in Jerusalem in the Time of Jesus. I was reading a section in that earlier this week. And he's explaining the economy of Israel between the time of the exile and the time of Jesus. And what he points out is they had no resources. If we're talking about significant natural resources, it was the one area in the ancient Near East with none. To the north, there was cedar. Egypt had abundant farmland. I mean, the Mesopotamia had gold, silver, and good farmland. So all the other areas had good natural resources. Israel had none. The only natural resource they had in abundance was building stone. And what kept their economy afloat? The only thing that kept their economy afloat was the temple in Jerusalem. Because Jews came from all over the world and gave their tithes to that temple in Jerusalem. And there was a lot of tourism as a result of that. And that's what kept the economy afloat. What a pathetic piece of land. It's not prime territory. And in recent times, I can't remember who it was, one of the leaders of the state of Israel once said, why are we the only area in the Middle East with no oil? It's a piece of worthless property. And yet God's going to make that the capital of the world? That's ridiculous. That's absurd. Jews. Why would God pick the Jews? I mean, and if anybody has proven themselves unworthy to be God's chosen people, it's the Jews, in a sense. Not that any of us would have done better. But they showed themselves to be unworthy of that designation. And yet, they are the ones through whom God is going to reveal himself? That's absurd. Jesus. Why would God become... If God, it's hard to imagine God becoming man. But it's even much harder to imagine God becoming Jesus. If he had become a great hero, a great ruler, that's one thing. But he became a poor carpenter, a nobody, an absolute nobody, a loser, penniless. That's absurd. Why would God then, having become man, die on the cross for his enemies? That's absurd. That makes no sense. So we could go on and on, but everything God has done is absurd. We laugh at it initially. We all would laugh at it initially. But when we think about it under more reflection, then we have an option. We have a choice to make. Are we going to laugh with joy because this is what God has chosen? Remarkable. That is truly gracious, phenomenal. And rejoice in that. The other option is to say, this is outrageous. If that's the kind of God that I'm being asked to serve, and if this is the kind of universe in which I am being asked to live, I'm out of here. I will not accept it. And there are a variety of ways that we can respond like that. We can change the universe in our minds. We can change God in our minds. There are a variety of ways that we can rebel against what God has done. But it all boils down to laughing at God with the same kind of laughter that Ishmael had. So there's a sense in which how we respond to each element of this plan of salvation that God is unfolding is indicative of what kind of person we are and how we respond to God in general. And I think that that's why he could say to Abraham, I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. Those who laugh with joy at each element of God's plan of salvation, he will bless. Those who laugh with derision, he will curse. Now, if that's true, that helps me understand why it is that in the Old Testament there's this perspective that all of the surrounding peoples, how they respond to Israel is indicative of their attitude towards God. If they are enemies of Israel, they are enemies of God. Why? Because Israel is playing this part in the plan of salvation. And if we really understood what was going on and were receptive to that, we would be cheering them on rather than fighting against them. Much as Ishmael, had he really understood and embraced what God was doing in Isaac, he would have graciously stepped aside and been respectful towards Isaac and said, Isaac, stand up and take your place. I'm stepping down. And I think that that's why our response to Jesus is so telling. Because Jesus is the centerpiece of this plan of salvation. Jesus is this absurdity, in a sense. But it's the absurdity that calls from us a response, Are we going to embrace it with joy and thanksgiving? Or are we going to say, that's ridiculous? So how we respond to Jesus is indicative of what we think of God in general. Now, it's important, as Kierkegaard points out, to understand that it's our response to the real Jesus, the Jesus of the New Testament, rather than some Jesus that's been constructed by our religious culture. Those can be very different things. And the question is, how do we respond to the Jesus who really lived and has been described in the Bible? But how we respond to him is indicative of what we think of God and our attitude towards him. It seems to me that this might have implications for how we think about what's going on in Israel as well, in our day and age. That there is a sense in which we should all be fans of God's chosen people waking up and taking their rightful place in history and becoming that people through whom God reveals himself and makes himself known. In that sense, I think we should be, if I'm understanding this correctly, we should be fans of Israel and what and be encouraging of them taking their rightful place. Now, there, as I look at Israel, it's very difficult for me to see it as though there are good guys and bad guys. It's hard for me to say, anything is the state of Israel does, I am going to applaud because they're God's chosen people. But I think we can be wisely supportive of them. We don't have to be supportive of every policy that they establish, but we need to be encouraging of them taking their place as God's chosen people, of waking up and seeing who they are in God's plan and playing that role. And I think that the growing hatred towards Israel throughout the rest of the world is indicative of a spiritual response and not just a political response to what's going on. That behind it all, there is, I think, a hatred of God's chosen people, because there is a hatred of God's plan of salvation and ultimately a hatred of God himself. So all I'm not really making a political statement so much as I'm saying, I think that we are to be fans of God's chosen people playing their rightful role, however that works its way out, rather than just being fans of whatever policies they establish. Okay. Those were all my comments on this chapter. Questions and comments from you.
When you mentioned about how the difference between how we respond to the cultural Jesus versus the real Jesus of the Bible made me think about how, read in an art book, how very many people would love to have a Van Gogh painting on their wall, but probably not very many people would like to have Van Gogh himself living with them.
On that comment, as far as discerning, like Kierkegaard said, who we think Jesus is the theology that we endorse, I'm not sure anybody's got a handle on that. I tend to think all of us, it's like a veil slowly being taken away, chiseled down, however, whatever context we live in, it seems like in spite of ourselves, God is showing himself who he actually is. So when I hear statements like from Kierkegaard, I'm not really sure how to take that. It sort of assumes that there are people who maybe with greater clarity than others, but where's the line drawn? In one hand, it could be an incredibly arrogant statement. The other one, it seems to be universal.
Yeah. I think the key question is, do we want to know? Because there's a sense in which, the way I envision it, it's like we have this vague understanding of who Jesus is. But we can kind of foresee where that would head. And there's some directions that we don't want it to go. I wouldn't like that kind of Jesus. And so we kind of steer ourselves in the direction of other options, other Jesuses. The only thing that will keep us from steering to one of those other options is if we are adamant, I want to know who the real Jesus is. And you're right, God is out there revealing all the time. But it is also true that we are constantly busy obscuring. And what has to happen is we have to resolve to not obscure. I'm willing to face into the truth, whatever it is. I want to know the truth. I want to know the real, the true Jesus, rather than some comic book version. But you don't have a mic.
Okay, when you opened this talk this morning, you had said in Genesis, out of light, out of darkness, chaos, order out of chaos. Doesn't that assume, for me, I've always thought the creation was how do you pronounce that?
Out of nothing.
Yeah, but how do you pronounce it?
Ex nihilo, I think.
Nihilo, okay. That's not accurate. If you have chaos or if you have darkness, you have matter.
Right.
Can you touch on that?
Well, my suspicion is that God did create out of ex nihilo. But the way that Moses has decided to depict that is to start with darkness, chaos, and chaos over the deep, over the deep is the term that it's used. I think all of those are symbolic of this nothingness. But what's important for Moses, Moses is not telling us how to create a universe. He's trying to paint this picture of who the Creator is more than anything else, and who is God with respect to him. And in order to do that, he's starting out with images that show chaos and darkness, out of which God is going to bring light and order. And I think that's the reason that the terms that are there have been chosen. I don't think he's trying to give us a blow-by-blow account of exactly how it was done. You see what I'm saying? Anything else?
I don't know if this is too much of a peripheral issue, but or question, but I'm curious. It seems like by Jewish law that Hagar should have maybe been stoned, possibly Abraham too, for having an extramarital affair. I mean, I don't know. I understand that in that culture that was pretty common for a man to have more than one wife. But I'm just curious, in your opinion, what God's response to something like that would be, because he goes ahead and blesses Ishmael so much and continues to care so much for Hagar, maybe because she's related to Abraham now in some way. Mm-hmm. Can you comment on that? I don't know if it's too big of a question.
Well, let me try. All of this occurs before the law is given to Moses, so that law is not codified at this point in time. So there's a sense in which I think Abraham and his contemporaries are groping for what is right and wrong to a degree that is greater than in the time of Moses. So that, I think, is a partial answer to it. But also, God in history is helping us to come to an understanding of what is right and wrong. And I think part of what happens in the story of Sarah and Hagar is actually advocating monogamy. If you look at Genesis, whenever we've got multiple wives, we've got multiplied troubles. We have it in Sarah and Hagar, but we also see it in Rachel and Leah. And I think that that's intentional. By custom at that time, multiple wives were common. But what we see here is it multiplies troubles. So God is using their experience to help us to understand what is right and wrong, much like he also uses our experience to help us to understand what is right and wrong. Okay. Anything else? Okay, thanks.